You are listening to the Effective Statistician Podcast, the weekly podcast with Alexander Schacht and Benjamin Pieske, designed to help you reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients while having a great work-life balance. In addition to our premium courses on the Effective Statistician Academy, we also have lots of free resources for you across all kind of different topics within that academy. Head over to theeffectivestatistician.com and find the academy and much more for you to become an effective statistician. I'm producing this podcast in association with PSI, a community dedicated to leading and promoting the use of statistics within the healthcare industry for the benefit of patients. Join PSI today to further develop your statistical capabilities with access to the ever-growing video-on-demand content library, free registration to all PSI webinars, and much, much more. Head over to the PSI website at psiweb.org to learn more about PSI activities and become a PSI member today. Welcome to another episode of The Effective Statistician. Today, I'm super excited to have Oscar with me here, and we will talk about clinical development plans for gene and cell therapy and how these then help to move into the post-commercialization phase. But before we dive a little bit further into that topic, maybe you can introduce yourself shortly.
Sure. First of all, Alexander, thank you so much for this opportunity to speak with you and your audience. I'm an MD, PhD. I work in academia for about 10 years, and I was able to get a tenure professorship of immunology. And at that time, I started to think, okay, I already did this. What do I do next? And in the next almost over 30 years now, I've been working in the biopharma industry. I'm working also in medtech, medical devices, and lately in biotechs. And working with biotechs, that's where I had the opportunity to focus on gene and cell therapies, what we're going to be discussing today. And the majority of my work, first when I worked, what I would say in my call to fame, was with AbbVie, Abbott Laboratories, or with the Humira team. It was a biotech. TNF, very well known, probably until recently with the new obesity drugs, best selling drug in history. And then I started working after my clinical development work, also in medical affairs with this company and with this asset. I moved into biotechs. And my jobs at biotechs were always overseeing the entire clinical development effort. And what that means is the majority of my roles were either supporting or being the chief medical officer. I recently resigned from my last job. There were a number of changes in my life, and I decided to move back into consulting. And that's what I'm doing right now. I run an organization called Medic Affairs Consulting LLC, and I provide support for clinical development, for medical affairs, across different therapeutics areas and across different types of needs for my clients.
Today, we want to talk a little bit specifically, not about these big blockbuster drugs like Humira. And yeah, I've worked on competitions of Humira quite a lot, but about exactly the opposite. Yeah, gene and cell therapy. If you think about your kind of history working on Humira and on indications probably like psoriasis, rheumatoid arthritis, and all these other diseases in this area where there's lots of patients. And now you jump into gene and cell therapy. From a clinical development point of view, that must be a huge difference, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very different. But look, when you're an immunologist by background, the first thing that you do is to understand the science. And what that means is that you are a molecular biologist, you're a protein biologist, and a cell biologist. Mm-hmm. That's why when I had the opportunity to rethink my career, and it was about 10 years ago, and I started going into this chief medical officer on this opportunity around gene and cell therapies, I realized, okay, I think especially gene therapy is going to be very easy to do. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely right. And I was right, because you understand the biology of the target, which is a gene that either is not functioning or missing, and you just want to replace it. So from a drug development perspective, you know what you're doing, and the possibility of failure is very low. And I can jump into my last...
You just made a statement that I want to dig a little deeper into. Why is the possibility of failure so low? Is it, don't you? You still need to do phase one studies and so on, isn't it?
Yeah, you do. But again, you know exactly what's the problem.
Yeah.
And you have the solution. Nowadays, gene therapy has been going on for over 20 years in humans, obviously much earlier than that in preclinical work. And during all these two decades, we know exactly how to synthesize a gene in the lab and to put together all the elements that you need to trigger the activity of this gene. We also know how to incorporate this gene into an individual. In my case, where I was focusing in one of my roles supporting our chief medical officer was into the motor neurons, working with AveXis, which was acquired by Novartis for over $7 billion. And I worked with that team. And they were able to incorporate a gene into these motor neurons of little babies that would die within months. Okay. And many of them have been already alive for over 10 years. So my focus was on incorporating or inserting these genes into the liver, which is even more, let's say, possible with different therapeutic areas. And the way I do that was focusing on hemophilia A. There is also hemophilia B. In both cases, you have a non-functional or missing gene for factor 8. Factor 8 is part of the cascade of the coagulation so that you are able, your blood is able to clot.
Yeah.
We know for many years, for decades even, that even in hemophilia A, that if you replace those the missing gene for factor 8, this patient is going to be able to sustain this activity factor 8 for life. And that's where I can go into more details. And that's what I was doing for the past 4.5 years.
So the method of action is absolutely clear. Yeah.
It's very well defined, has been developed. There are many companies working on this. ISC Therapeutics is a small biotech in the Bay Area. But you have Pfizer collaborating with Sangamo. They just announced that they have also a factor 8 gene available. You have Roche, and they acquired Spark Therapeutics, and they also have developed another gene therapy for hemophilia A. And there is also BioMarine, and this is the only approved factor 8 for hemophilia A. I can go into the details why we were doing that when our competition was so big and strong.
Yeah. If you know the method of action, and I know I've worked in psychiatry and these kind of areas, and there's everything but the method of action very clear, because in the brain is so complex that you think you understand a couple of things, but there's so many different factors involved. Yeah. And then you still need to do your phase one studies to assure that your drug is safe and you have the right dose. And then I think with gene therapy, you only have more or less one goal per patient, isn't it? You can't have a dose escalation or anything like that, isn't it?
That's correct. So the reason for that is that we use AAV, an adeno-associated virus, and we give to the patient this virus containing the synthesized gene plus all the elements that are necessary to ensure that that genes function once you insert that into the liver cell, the hepatocyte. And because you use such an incredible amount of viruses in the trillions, or viruses, this patient develops an immune response and becomes totally unable to receive another time, another go with any other AAV. So any patient receiving a gene therapy cannot receive any other gene therapy using this methodology, which we call AAV gene therapies. So you're right. So you do all your pre-analytical work on animal models, on monkeys, and once you have it identified, you have usually two or three doses that you want to test in patients. And then you have a dose escalation phase 1, 2A, we call it, because we don't have an actual phase 2. So we move from the only pre-pivotal trial study to the pivotal trial. And in that study, we define the actual dose that you need to the patient. But we can use that one dose per patient. We see how it works. Then we go to the next patient. So we treat, in general, 3 to 4 patients with one dose. We move to the next cohort and to the next cohort, and we decide which one is working. Okay. And I can tell you with ASA Therapeutics, we were able to treat the first cohort. It worked very nicely, and we were able to start preparing for the second cohort. I found it, to tell you the truth, a little bit boring because it takes forever to do these clinical trials. We had already a number of competitors doing very well, but we had a specific and a different type of gene therapy that brought another differentiating factor that we thought when I was with the company would be very helpful. So indeed, you still need a phase 1 clinical trial. And this is just between 8 to 12 patients. It's not more than.
So I have another question. So if we basically just replace the gene, how do we then have different drugs? Aren't then all the drugs more or less exactly the same? Is that all basically copies of the original drug? Because that's just my naive question. Yeah. So if you have, if you think about, for example, Humira, yeah, there's lots of different anti-TLFs, and they are all different biological entities. Yeah, they all have a little bit of a different method of action and so on, different binding affinity and all these kind of different things. And my very naive assumption being just a statistician, if you will, replacing a gene is basically always exactly the same. What's the difference between the different drugs then?
This is an excellent question. And that's also what I would wonder. And you would say, why did I do that? Having three top competitors, one of them already an FDA approved, why would I do this and going into this space? First of all, because it's hemophilia A. So this is, although this is a rare disease, it's very common, relatively common as a rare disease, and there is a huge market. Mm-hmm. So when the entire process of developing of these drugs started about, I would say, about 10 years ago now, believe it or not, the actual effort by Pfizer, Roche, and BioMarin, we haven't started yet. Everyone thought, okay, my God, this is a huge market, relatively. Everyone started to think a lot in gene therapies or diseases. But you are absolutely right. All the gene therapies, all these three companies working on gene therapies would do basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. There is no patent protection or something like that. Genes cannot be patented. It's all about methodology. It's about little details about how do you produce your gene therapy? How do you deliver it? Mm-hmm. And what the dose and what are your costs? Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you have heard that, everyone has heard that these therapies are extraordinarily costly, are between, I would say, $1 and $3 million per patient per dose to treat the patient only once. And in some cases, like recently in the UK, NICE, which is the reimbursement agency in the UK, just approved one of these drugs for this.
The differences are in the delivery. So you talked about it's basically sent through a virus into the, and I think this kind of virus capsule, so to say, That can be different, isn't it? So that is more the methodology around it. Is that correct?
Yeah. For instance, we use different types of AAV. They're numbered from 1 to 10. And some people use AAV5, other AAV8, others AAV9, and so on. Mm-hmm. And that could be one difference. But at the end of the day, believe it or not, it doesn't matter. The moment that you get one of these AAVs, it doesn't matter which one, you are going to be immunized for all other AAVs, mm-hmm. as I said at the beginning. So that's the first thing to take into account. Now, what that's one difference. But another difference is be able to have a very low dose. Mm-hmm. If you have a low dose because of the high cost of manufacturing, you're going to be able to reduce the cost. That's something that is important, and everyone is trying to do that. Now, what happened in AAV and why I got out of that, I mean, with hemophilia A, and why I decided to get out of that space, is because Roche came up with a way to treat patients with hemophilia A so that they would not need to go, as happens with these patients practically, they need to go in their hospitals in a regular basis, even twice a week. So when this new drug came to the market, everyone started realizing, okay, gene therapy is losing totally the value for these patients. And this is what has happened. BioMarin launched their drug over 1.5 years ago, and they want to divest that asset. It has a complete disaster economically for the company. They replaced the CEO, and I think they sold in 2 years or in 1.5 years, maybe they were able to treat 5 to 10 patients or something like that. Mm-hmm. Absolutely catastrophic. Yeah. We were bringing
to what did Ross exactly you said made them so successful as compared to BioMarin?
Yeah, it'd be because the drug was given once a month.
Okay.
And they could be used at home.
Okay. See, but isn't it that you treat gene therapy only once?
Yeah, but this is not a gene therapy.
Ah, okay. 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 So that is interesting. So Ross basically, teamwork was a much, much cheaper, not curative option, but that basically helps patients to maintain things and over a longer period. Okay, okay. Let's go a little bit further into the discussion about the clinical development plan. Phase one. So very often phase one is about non-patients, healthy subjects. But in gene and cell therapy, it would be always like in oncology, usually these would be patients, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And so you can also directly measure the efficacy. So that's why it is basically a phase one, two step, isn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, and then how would your phase three then look like? Would you need, like in very often in other diseases, especially the big ones, two confirmatory trials to meet the requirements for submission?
So once you have a successful phase one clinical trial in gene therapies, moving into pivotal trials means that you have already defined your dose and you need to treat a number of patients to ensure that there is also long-term efficacy. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is ensuring that you have the right amount of patients that are going to be showing efficacy over time. And you don't need, which is a kind of difference between gene therapies and other type of therapies, placebo arm or a control arm. So basically, the agency is going to accept the data that you have.
That is interesting. So you basically run a single arm study as a phase three. And with that, from an efficacy side of view, I can understand it because you will know that placebo just has, or standard of care, has zero effect. Yeah. The question I have is, how do you establish a clear safety profile then if you don't have a placebo?
This type of therapy is so different and so specific that we have already a number of rules, let's say, for safety. obviously, safety management is critical in any kind of study. You have already done that in your phase one clinical trial. The agency is able to review that. The pivotal trial should not bring any surprises. The main safety aspects that you want to take into account are related to the actual therapy with viruses. Mm-hmm. So second is related to the fact that in our case, for instance, we are targeting the liver. And what that means is that we are inducing a kind of hepatitis. Mm-hmm. So we are infecting actually the liver with these trillions of viruses. And what you see often is that these patients start to develop increase in liver enzymes that indicate damage to the liver. So mm-hmm. you don't want these levels to go too high. And that's something that obviously you have already looked into a balance when you decided what's the dose mm-hmm. you wanted to use in pivotal trial. Another aspect that you want to check is once your liver cell, the hepatocyte in our case, with hemophilia A and several other gene therapies, is producing this protein, in our case again, factor 8, you want to see that this factor 8 is also not inducing a response, an immune response that is going to counteract the factor 8, which that could be very negative for a patient because they could not even receive another therapy in the future.
Yeah.
So that's for factor 8 because you give factor 8 and the factor 8 is blocked or inhibited. These are basically the main aspects that you want to check with these patients from a safety perspective.
And what is the typical follow-up time that you need for these phase 3
studies? That's again a very interesting question. The FDA requires us to follow each and every patient receiving our gene therapy, us or any other gene therapy company, for 5 years. Mm-hmm. So the trial usually is able to give us an indication that the patient is working, that the gene therapy is working within, I would say, 6 months. You want to continue following this patient for about 1 year very thoroughly in a very structured way, but the FDA wants to see data for up to 5 years. So that means that the sponsor is required to follow this patient for 5 years. Mm-hmm. Once the patient reaches these 5 years, then all patients in gene therapies must go into registries for life.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that works. That's a little bit far away for me, or it was. Who pays for that? But at the end of the day, gene therapy is a relatively new therapeutic modality, and you want to make sure that these patients don't have any kind of issue with this therapy over time, because we are learning all about gene therapies in humans.
Mm-hmm. Very good. What's your experience working with statisticians on these kind of clinical development plans? Because I think from a statistics point of view, so it seems to be like, tell me the number, and then we provide you with some proportions and some means and some standard deviations, and that's about it.
Yeah, first of all, I think that the role of the statisticians in drug development is absolutely crucial, also in gene therapies.
Mm-hmm.
And we can also talk about cell therapies later on. But in principle, even being such a small, let's start with the phase 1-2A clinical trial, which is the way we define this first step with the dose-ranging study, we need to make sure that we have the right type of descriptive statistics. Mm-hmm. There is no sample size. Everything is very well established. It's always the same. But depending on how it works over time with your different doses, you may need more dosing. You need to confirm the dose that you have decided from 3 to 6 patients, maybe 9 patients. And for that, actually, you don't need a very thorough statistical plan. But when you come to the actual protocol and the submission to the agency for the IND, you need to provide an SAP and a statistical analysis plan. And there you also indicate this is the number of patients that I'm going to incorporate, this is my sample size, and so on. A different story is when you go into the pivotal trial. Depending on the results that you got on the phase one, then we work with the statisticians to ensure that we get not only the right sample size and that we see the change that we expect, that we also see the expected effect size. And that means that it's not just going throughout the, depending on the data, the number of patients have failed, that you see not only statistical significance, but that they have practical means, practical meaning, so that you actually are going to see that this drug is going to work in patients. And the agency is very strict. And sometimes BioMarin got a delay of almost 2 years with also gene therapy for hemophilia A, because they tried to mix together data from the pivotal trial with phase one, several phase one clinical trials, and the agency didn't like that. So they want consistency. They want to make sure that you, in your clinical protocol, the way you treat your patients is very consistent. So that's why the agency came back to them and told them, no, you need to have a very clean pivotal trial, phase three trial, that includes all the patients under the same umbrella of the protocol and ensuring that all of them can be analyzed in a very consistent manner. And that's when we also work very closely with the statisticians.
Yeah. Thanks so much for this very, very nice deep dive into gene therapy and especially how it works, how the different drugs compare to each other, the different challenges in phase one, two, and three, and your perspective on working together with statisticians on that. What is your key takeaways that anybody who would like to learn more about gene therapy, what should say, would be your key recommendation for them?
I'm going to be a little bit self-serving here, and I'm trying I would suggest that you start reading an entire book that I wrote together with a number of experts in the space, and I was honored to be asked to write chapter one, which was an introduction to gene therapy and how you use biomarkers and how you use statistics and everything. The book is in Wiley. I don't remember now the actual details, but
we will put it in the show notes.
Google Books. And I would say that's a start, but there is an incredible amount of information out there. I have also written several articles, and even, for instance, for the gene therapy that I just mentioned, for hemophilia A, I wrote a review with Professor Steve Pipe, which is the guru of hemophilia A, and we wrote an overview about how our gene therapy was different from the three others that I mentioned, and I don't need to go into details about that. But I would say, I would recommend that someone takes one specific therapeutic target, and I would recommend, because I know that very well, and there is an incredible amount of literature on factor VIII replacement. If you understand one of them very well, you're going to be able to move into other gene therapies. There is also everything related to SMN1, which is, again, what AveXis developed on patients with the spinal muscular atrophy. It was an incredible, it's now a blockbuster in some ways, a drug where Novartis, when you go to Novartis and you go to Zolgensma, you can see a lot of information. Yeah. So that's what I would recommend. For instance, take Zolgensma and take the hemophilia A factor VIII and start to understand and read about that. But I personally, I have several review articles and the book I just mentioned.
Okay. We'll put links to all of that in the show notes. Thanks so much, Oscar, for this great discussion about gene therapy.
Thank you so much for this opportunity.
This show was created in association with PSI. Thanks to Rain and her team at VVS who helped with the show in the background, and thank you for listening. Reach your potential, lead great science, and serve patients. Just be an effective statistician.